This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The nation of Syria was once associated with beauty, culture, history, and sadly, a long-term dictatorship. Today, it is synonymous with war, destruction, and refugees. It is rare for us here in the West to hear about the impact of the Syrian crisis and its history from the perspective of a Syrian and a journalist. Today, we'll turn to just such a person who has written a searing political and personal story of her country. Alia Malek is a Syrian-American journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Policy, The New Yorker, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, Jedalia, McSweeney's, Guernica, and other publications. She's the author of several books, including A Country Called America, U.S. History Retold Through Arab-American Lives, and editor of Patriot Acts, Narratives of Post-9/11 Injustices. She was also a senior writer at Al Jazeera America and a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. In April of 2011, she moved to Damascus, Syria, and wrote anonymously for several outlets from inside the country as it began to disintegrate. Her reporting from Syria earned her the Marie Colvin Award in November 2013. She now joins me to discuss her newest book. It's called The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. Welcome to the program, Alia.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about what it was that took you back to Syria. You're a Syrian-American. You were born in the United States, but you kept your connection, your legal connection to Syria. How did you, what made you go to Syria, and how was it that you're allowed in as a journalist?
Well, if we can remember back to the early months of 2011, it was kind of an optimistic time in the Middle East, in the region. It seemed that after years of stagnation and political dictatorships, not just in Syria, but also in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, that things were starting to finally give. And at that, it was that moment in time that I thought it might be a good opportunity to be in Syria as both a journalist and a human rights lawyer, but also maybe a last chance to sort of be in the Syria and to live in the Syria that I had always known and never been fully a part of as a member of the diaspora. And also both as a human rights lawyer and as a journalist, it would have obviously been, you know, kind of bad for my health to have practiced either of those vocations inside Syria. So it felt like the last chance at the same time to go back and to live and to be part of the society at what was obviously going to be a seismic and critical moment, but one that I thought might lead to a better version of Syria. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. As for access, I am considered a Syrian national. I have a Syrian national ID card, and as such, there's not the same scrutiny in the initial sense of my coming into the country. Though obviously I was not able to practice journalism openly when I was there. Anything I wrote while I was in Damascus, I did not take a byline for. But I was there really for a longer term project as it was, which was starting to figure out how to put together a book on Syria, which I had always wanted to write. And ironically, now there was an audience for it.
And so the story of your country is told through the story of your own family and the deep roots that you have in Syria. There's much to talk about there, and it's a personal story as well. But how many transitions politically has your family witnessed throughout Syria? I mean, Syria has been under dictatorship for a long time, but before that period, there was a lot of political tumult. And today, of course, there is, despite the fact that Assad is holding on to power as strongly as he can.
Well, just 100 years ago, Syria was still a part of the Ottoman Empire, and it had been a part of that empire for about 400 years. So that's why I start the story with my great-grandfather and his mother, because they were living in that moment in Syria when it transitioned from the Ottoman Empire to what would have happily have maybe been independence, but instead wasn't. It was the French Mandate era, and then, you know, delayed independence of about for several more decades. And then my grandmother, with whom this, you know, which is where the story picks up after I talk about the earlier generations. I mean, from the late 1940s until 1970, there wasn't a lot of longevity for Syrian governments. There were in her first year of marriage, there were three different coups. That was also her first year in Damascus. So if there was one thing that marked the politics of Syria until 1970. It was constant change. And then when Hafez al-Assad took power in 1970, that was like the last coup in many senses. And it is his regime that has continued on through his son. So like any other Syrian family, we have not seen transition since 1970. But before that, of course, generations of my family were witness to the sort of instability that characterized Syria after independence.
So despite that instability and despite the dictatorship and then the passing on of that regime to the son that has ensued, Syria is a country, as I mentioned, rich in history and culture and beauty. But today, if you just Google Syria, just the word Syria, and look up images on Google, all you see are the horrific images of destruction and death and rubble. Paint a picture for us of what Syria was like before this latest horrific war, just for a Western audience to get an understanding of how this country was before the worst of the violence.
Well, let me preface everything that I'm about to say with that Syria was a state that was clearly within the grips of a totalitarian regime that was kept in control by a secret police. So there was this amazing layer of beauty that I'll paint a picture of, but people have to understand that there was this sort of subtext that you were always being watched, that there weren't any kinds of political freedoms.
But so Syria, sort of a peaceful prison, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it was stable. I mean, that was part of the bargain in many ways between the people this is the bargain that you make in a dictatorship, that there is stability and there is predictability and the rules of engagement are fairly clear. Do not dissent openly, do not shake the boat. And this is sort of like the parameters of your life are kind of well understood. But Syria has been, I mean, in many ways blessed from its beginning. It's at the crossroads of many different civilizations and continents. It's on the Eastern Mediterranean, and as such, you know, had a long Roman and Hellenic history. Before that, it was, you know, it reads like a greatest hits of the classics era. It's one of the oldest still existing civilizations in the world. It's been a continuous habitation. It's on the Silk Road. It is part of the East. It is also part of, you know, the Arabian Gulf. It's right on the border of Turkey, and Turkey reaches into Europe. So it's a place where it's like everybody has kind of come through Syria. And that sort of diversity has meant a diversity in terms of its people, what makes it up the ethnic makeup of the place. There are, of course, Arabic speaking people who we would call Arabs. There are also Kurds, there are Circassians, there are Armenians, there were Jews, there are still Christians and Muslims of different sects of both of those religions. I mean, it's a place that was truly rich along a lot of the indicators that we would look at for diversity. And it is a place of varied geography. It is on the Mediterranean, but it's also on the border of the Asian interior. It's a place that I think, and I've said this before, and I said this years ago, that if Americans had had, or West Americans had had the same kind of exposure to Syria, to say that we have had to Italy, we would have had the same kind of romantic notions. You know, Europeans have had that romanticism about Syria for a longer period because it's closer and they've traveled there and they've been tourists there. But it is an incredibly rich place, and its loss shouldn't be mourned just by Syrians. Mm. It should have been mourned by the entire world, and it should have been something that we try to preempt. You know, the idea that you just arm people and throw them into an armed conflict against a state, one that is backed by two nuclear states, namely Russia and Iran, and think that that's going to turn out well, was a tragedy. And that's the idea. And I think those were decisions oriented in people not being invested in not losing Syria. To them, it was just, I don't know, maybe it was just another military theater. But for many of us, it was this incredible place that no matter whatever emerges in the future of Syria will not be the same, for better and for worse.
My only sort of knowledge of Syria as a child was when my mother visited Damascus end of the 1970s, and all she told me about was what a beautiful, beautiful country it had been. So let's talk about the experience that you had in 2011 in Syria as the revolution was unfolding. You know, there's been books written about it. There's some sort of strange debate about whether the initial uprising uprising was peaceful versus armed and whether it started out peaceful and became armed. But tell us about what you personally experienced. We know about Egypt's Tahrir Square. It turns out Damascus has a Tahrir Square too, right?
Right. Yes, I wrote about it. And I felt, because I used to pass through that Tahrir Square every day. And as I got closer and closer in the car, there would be the signs for Tahrir Square. And I started to feel like it was personally taunting me, a sort of reminder that what had happened in Egypt was not going to happen in the United States. I just want to say, I don't think there's a debate, at least for me, I was there at the beginning. I don't think it's a debate as to whether or not it started off peaceful. It truly did start off as peaceful. People asking for reforms. People were fired, you know, the first shots were fired by the regime. And I don't think it's fair. And it does a disservice to the people who were sacrificed their lives early on to pretend that that actually is a debate. I don't think it's a debate as to what was going on in 2011. When I got there, you know, it was a place of a ton of worry and anxiety. I think there were people, of course, there was some optimism that maybe, you know, this regime looks different than Hafez al-Assad's regime. It's younger, it's more modern, supposedly. It appears to have a modern outlook. The president and his wife appeared interested in strengthening civil society, even if it was under their auspices. So I think there were people who thought, who were cautiously optimistic. Then there were other people Syrians who always saw the regime as the son's regime as a continuation of the father's regime. And they remembered Hama in 1982 and how brutally, you know, the regime had put down an uprising that was violent initially, but not only violent. And I think there were people who were quite afraid of what could happen and what measures the regime would be willing to go to hold on to power. So it was very tense when I arrived, I would say. And there was also a fear of the Islamists from all sectors, a fear that even if there was a peaceful transition, that they would win in democratically the way that had happened in Egypt or in Tunisia. You know, I think people think that is a fear, like the fear of political Islam is only in non-Sunni communities, but that's not true. There was definitely trepidation about that within Sunni communities. You know, and I found a place in 2011, people who didn't want to see everything become the kind of chaos that they knew intimately being on the border of Iraq. I mean, don't forget, Syria has been taking in Iraqi refugees for a long time. Syria's taken in Palestinian refugees. Syria's on the border of Lebanon and had seen the consequences of civil war there. So, you know, I don't think there was any kind of romance or romantic notions about what could happen or how bad things could get. And people feared that.
And when you sort of watched these struggles unfold, did you have any sense of how far this regime would go to retain its power and how many international actors would come to its aid?
Well, to the latter question, I mean, it was clear that Iran was propping up the regime and the currency from the early stages. Did I think that Russia would be interested in an imperialist intervention in Syria? No, I can't say that was totally clear. I didn't think Hezbollah or Hassan Nasrallah would necessarily be so unstrategic as to get involved in the Syrian conflict and to also like lose ground and legitimacy within Lebanon because of that involvement to some extent. And I never foresaw that this massive human displacement would happen. No, it's been an absolute catastrophe, and it's heartbreaking.
Tell us about your leaving Syria. That's how you open your book, that you decided to leave Syria, and many of your family members in Syria were very happy that you were leaving Syria.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Syria is a place, Damascus is a city where there is no anonymity in it. People are always watching. So the fact that here I was, this Syrian American who was a journalist and before that a human rights lawyer who had to some extent a kind of public profile. You could Google me at the time. It drew just too much attention. And once the restoration of the house had finished, it became harder to defer, you know, to defer questions as to what are you doing here and why would you be here at this moment in time? And the suspicions that I might either be practicing journalism or that I might be a spy. And, you know, there were family members who wanted me to leave because they cared for me and they didn't want to see me hurt. And there were family members who wanted me to leave so that they wouldn't be hurt. And that's one of the ways that Syrian regime has effectively controlled the people, that acts of dissent or opposition are not, the consequences of that are not borne only by the individual who practices that dissent or opposition, but by their family, sometimes their neighborhood. So it's a heavy price to ask others to pay on your behalf. And it got, you know, and I was conscious of the fact that I had the privilege of an American citizenship. Should anything have happened to me, I would have been, or if I got wind that something might happen to me, I would be able to potentially leave very quickly and easily. Or if I were detained, there'd be, in theory, like the United States government working for my release. But that cannot be said of Syrians who have nothing else but Syrian nationality. And it just started to become, even if I would have wanted to stay, it wasn't just about me anymore.
Hmm. Aliya, how do you respond to this particular strain on the American left that is convinced that all of the repressive policies attributed to the Assad regime are exaggerations and that they're overblown? I mean, we see this over and over again, particularly from the left, despite well-documented crimes, you know, barrel bombings, chemical weapons, we see a lot of denial of the Assad regime being responsible for the majority of violence on the ground.
Yes. Well, first, let me just say, are they really the left? I mean, or if they're a left, it's a left without true principles. And
even the attacks on the White Helmets with the Netflix documentary, yes. It's been kind of surprising to see, you know, them being dismissed as tools of U.S. AID.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing about that is that these are, you know, I'll use your term that you call them, people on the left, that they are people who are always talking about how much, you know, it's as if they want to, they're trying to be spokespeople for the people who are being oppressed by, you know, imperialist interventions, but they yet somehow, you know, they are doing in many ways the same things that they decry. They're depriving the Syrian people, in this case, of any kind of agency that Syrians might have wanted to have exercised the same rights that these people here are able to have. And I don't know, just to me, it seems like, well, it's not fair to call them leftist or we should say that this is an unprincipled kind of leftist discourse. It is not untrue. See, the same thing that I found in Syria, that there were people who couldn't handle parallel truths, the same can be said of the sector that gives this argument. There were plenty of people who would say to me that when you know, we would be discussing this, we'd be saying, you know, why, you know, these Syrian people are protesting the corruption, they're protesting this, they're protesting that. And the response to that was, didn't, you know, the United States invade Iraq under false premises, and as if that somehow canceled out these other kinds of truths and realities. It is true that there is a lot of external meddling happening in Syria right now. I'm not going to be put in the position where I have to deny that, to also be able to say that there is agency that is being, you know, being utilized by the Syrian people to try to have some say in their own destinies and their own futures. And it has been disheartening to hear people articulate those arguments, especially when it's come from people who supposedly represent Palestinian interests, because Palestinians on the ground in Palestine I think they recognize what is going on in Syria, and they've spoken against that kind of use of the Palestinian interest to say that, you know, this is just
external. And you as a journalist have reported from Palestine, right?
I never worked as a journalist in Palestine. I worked as a lawyer. My first time there was in 1998. I understand the Palestinian cause, and I believe that the Palestinians have a right to self-determination. I hope that I've been principled in my work and statements on Palestine. Palestine is part of the book as well.
Yeah.
But yes, you know, it's hard for me to understand how people who are so concerned with the agency of you know, the victims of imperialism, not at the same time depriving these people, Syrians, of any kind of agency and understanding what they're looking at. I mean, there are imperialist interventions that are happening, yes, from the Gulf, but there are also imperialist interventions happening by Iran and Russia and Syria, and I don't understand why we can't look at both in parallel. They're not mutually exclusive, and I don't want to be put into this corner where I have to say that only one is true.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you explaining that, because every time we cover Syria, we do get members of our audience writing in angrily about our coverage of it, that we've tried to keep as principled as possible. Finally, Aliyah, I want to ask you about the title of your book. It's called The Home That Was Our Country. Was. Why? Why do you have that past tense?
So this was a huge debate between me and my publishers. And I also sort of bristled at was. You know, I had suggested, it was like the last title in several titles that I had suggested. And I said, you know, part of the reason I'm against was is, first, because I don't want any kind of false nostalgia. I think there's a tendency to romanticize, because right now is so horrible that somehow, like in an absolute sense, what was before was somehow great. No, relative to maybe it was better. That's another debate. And also, you know, for Syrians, it's not, nobody wants to say that there was a was. And I understand, I know that, like, for me and for other Syrians, like, the was is upsetting. But I think, you know, the way I was able to kind of rationalize it to myself was that no matter what emerges, so it's not saying that Syria is done, Syria lives on, but like whatever emerges will be very different than what was before. And the, because, you know, the house is also a parallel, sort of a metaphor for the entire country, that the community, when my grandmother lived in that house versus when my mother lived in that house versus when the people who took the house from it lived in it versus when I lived in it, these are very different iterations of Syria. And I think it was sort of trying to capture that idea. But I, you know, you're not the first person to ask me that. I've got to come up with a very good answer, because I'm going to keep getting asked that. I realize that. And I know it's painful to Syrians to see that was. But, you know, we will see. I mean, I in the end, you know, what we all want is, and are looking towards is, or questioning is, what will be the Syria? That what will be our home? What will be our country? I mean, I think so. It's okay to say that this phase is going to be sort of something that won't exist again.
I'm sure you get this other question a lot too, which is, what can be done about Syria? And a lot of ordinary Americans who see the crisis there and are pained by the photos, particularly of children and mothers and whole families fleeing and also being mistreated where they land, it's very, very disturbing. And people feel a little helpless here in the United States, because we don't want to say the U.S. should intervene and drop bombs to destroy the Assad regime. But then how do we help or make a difference for this crisis to do some real solidarity work with a country that's really being destroyed?
Yeah, well, first of all, intervention doesn't only mean dropping bombs. And I can understand why everybody's reticent to drop bombs. But if you want to go back in time, the Obama administration was negotiating a huge nuclear deal with Iran. Iran was one of the principal backers of the regime. There was leverage, and the U.S. decided not to exercise that leverage. And the idea that, you know, we're just going to arm people and see what happens, to me, is like adding fuel to fire. The Syrian state, how are you going to beat the state, the capital S state, when the name of the game is violence? So, you know, a state that has an air force. So, that's a historical question to maybe discuss what else could have been done. But now what to be done? Basically, you cannot displace an entire country. You cannot displace all the people who don't want either, you know, ISIS's vision for the region or the Assad, you know, vision for the country. So the only real solution is to return Syria, is to allow Syria to be their home again. But this is what people are somehow failing to understand. No, that's not going to happen as long as a symbolic head of the regime is still there. So this idea that, you know, Assad should, you know, he'll never be legitimate to all the people that have now chosen to sort of reject the situation in Syria. So if we want them to not be mistreated abroad, we need them to be able to have a home state, a home country where they can have lives and dignity. And they cannot have lives and dignity right now. And if we're not willing to do that, then we have to be willing to, you know, make room for them in the societies that can take them. In which should, you know, we, there's been so much fretting about how many people the U.S. can take or Europe. I mean, let's look at Jordan. Iraq, Lebanon, Turkey, they're the ones bearing most of the burden of the Syrian refugee problem. And that's going to destabilize those places potentially. I mean, the only ultimate solution is a Syria where Syrians can live. And this the idea that that can happen with Assad still in power seems to me, this is not about politics or like what you believe. It just seems to me that that's not tenable. That's not viable. So what are the other alternatives after that? And I think we need to get out of these false dichotomies where it's either the strong man in an Armani suit without the beard versus the guy in the beard and, you know, the black flag. There's, you know, Syrians are an incredibly successful diaspora. They're incredibly rich people that contribute, rich in terms of what they can contribute, not just financially, to the societies that they become a part of. So how is it that those are the only alternatives that exist in Syria?
Right. It's not just ISIS or Assad. There is much more in between. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website where people can find out more about your work, Alia?
Sure, aliamalik.com. And they can find out there also about Europa, which is the book that I edited last year, which is the free guide for refugees and migrants as well, and everything about the new book and events and press and reviews.
Wonderful.
And they can get in touch with me too. Thank you, Sanal.
Thank you very much. My guest, Alia Malek, and that's A-L-I-A-M-A-L-E-K. Alia Malek is a Syrian-American journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Policy, The New Yorker, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, and more. And we've been discussing her newest book, The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUwithSonali.